Hello, and welcome to this episode of Criminal Mischief, The Art and Science of Crime Fiction. I'm your host, D.P. Lyle. Last time we talked about identifying a corpse, that you don't know who it is, bodies found, and you have to go through all the steps, and we spent 25 minutes on talking about that. Today I want to talk about skeletal remains, which is a whole nother can of worms for investigators as far as identifying who this person is. Now, if you've only got bones, obviously you don't have tissues, you don't have things like tattoos, you don't have things like birthmarks, you don't have facial recognition, as it were. Nobody's going to, you take a picture, nobody's going to recognize this person. There's not going to be that kind of stuff available. And so it makes things a lot more difficult. And often the medical examiner will call in a forensic anthropologist, because forensic anthropologies deal with bones and deal with all the aspects that we're going to talk about here. So let's say some bones are found in a wooded area and there's no tissues, there's nothing else, there's just bones. Okay, the first question is what condition are they in? How many of them are present? One thing I want to point out is you don't find skeletal remains once the body's decayed out in the real world, like your skeleton hanging in the corner of the room in your high school science class. They don't remain articulated. Now, as a body decays, the soft tissues, the muscles and skin and fat cells and organs and all that decay first, and the tendons and ligaments that hold the bones together take a little longer to decay. So there may be some articulation of the skeleton. There may be a lot of articulation. And by articulation, I mean the joints are still held together. And so it looks like a skeleton. But as time goes on, these break down, and what you have is a pile of bones. Let's add to this Mother Nature. There could be wind, there could be mudslides, there could be water, there could be rain. The body could have been dumped in a creek, and the bones, when they separate and decay and scatter, they could be far and wide. The predators come in and chew on bones and eat bones and crunch them and destroy them and drag them off to other places. So at the end of the day, you may not have a complete skeleton to work with. One other point, obviously the dental examinations, just like in a corpse, will be important here, but all the teeth may not be present, and many of them have probably fallen out of the jawbone, and so teeth are scattered around and loose. So it takes a very meticulous examination to the entire area where the skeleton's found. They have to sift the dirt, etc., because they want to look for every tooth they can find, because the more they have, the better they can make a dental comparison, if it comes to that. So right from Jump Street, you need to know how many bones you have present and which ones, both of which can make a big difference, as you will see. So the first question, let's say you just find a single bone. Is this a human bone or is it something else? I mean, the ribs of larger animals like sheep and cows and deer and stuff like this, especially baby cows, can look a lot like human bones. You know, the bones in the hands of a bear are very similar to the bones in a human in many respects. Babies, remember, their skulls are made up of several different little plates, and they're not fused together for a while. So what you may find is just a little curved bone, and sometimes this looks like a young turtle shell or something like that. So the point is that you first have to determine, are these bones, do they belong to a human? Now, if you find a skull or a femur or a pelvis, then you pretty much know what you're dealing with. So one of the first questions that has to be answered is, how old is this person? Because remember, we're dealing with a missing person, and like I talked about last time, the more you know about the physical structure, if you will, of this person, the better you can analyze it against missing person reports, against potential identification. The more you can do, the better. So if you can determine the age, is this a 5-year-old? Is this a 15-year-old? Is this a 45-year-old? Is this an 85-year-old? It makes a difference. It makes a difference as to who you're looking for. Well, one of the things obviously you look at is the teeth. Let's say all the teeth are there and they're still fairly well in the jaw. The baby teeth, there's about 20. And then when you get to be an adult, the permanent teeth are 32. And those changes, that transition occurs from about age 10, 11, 12, when you start losing your baby teeth and your other teeth come in, to about age 18 or so when the wisdom teeth finally come in. And so during this transition period, the anthropologist can look at this and say, oh, okay, fine. You know, we kind of have maybe he's around 14, 15, 16 years old because there's still some deciduous teeth, but yet there's more permanent teeth, et cetera. So you can look at all of this. Also with aging, the teeth get more worn, especially in older people. They get worn. There's decay. There's previous fillings and maybe even some artificial teeth, you know, some implants or some dentures or something. All of this stuff will play in to looking at the age of the individual and then maybe with dental records, finding out who it is. The skull. The skull isn't all that good in adults because once the bones of the skull have fused together, as I talked about infants, there's multiple bones there. And once these suture lines close and get set, then whether someone's 25 or 35 or 40, the skull doesn't really help you all that much. The long bones, the legs and the arms are called the long bones. They can be helpful up to a certain point. The growth plates on the bones are toward the ends of each of the long bones, and as long as they are open, the bones can grow. And so that's why children grow and grow and grow and grow. But about the time you're age somewhere between 20 and 25, these growth plates have closed, and their length growth is no longer possible. So after about age 25, the opening and closing of the growth plates really doesn't help you. But if you find that they're very active and the bones are smaller, you may say, well, this is a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old. This is someone who's not matured yet. You would think you could tell just from the length of the bone, but that's not always true. You know, some 10-year-olds are approaching 6 feet, and then there's adults that are 5'1". So the length of the bone doesn't really tell you that much. Same with the fusion of the bones of the pelvis, the pubic symphysis, which is you can look at that. This is where the bones of the pelvis join right in the front. There's a thin band of cartilage there, and it fuses together. But that's not the end of the story. So you can, if it's not fused, you can say it's a younger person. If it is fused, you can tell, okay, well, they're mature. But as it has kind of a wavering shape to it, it's kind of like a worm. It is not straight line, this junction. But as we age, it tends to straighten out. And so by about age 50, this fusion point is a pretty straight line. So now you have another marker along the age pathway before 50 or after 50. The ribs undergo same thing. Then they get arthritis in the ribs. You get arthritis in the other joints. You can look at bone densities and determine how much calcium's in there through x-ray examinations. And our bones tend to get denser up to a certain point, and then they start withering again. And this is osteoporosis and all that we see in older people. But there's also certain diseases and malnutrition that can affect this. So it's not all black and white. So the next thing you want to determine after you got the age, and actually all these are going on in parallel, of course, is estimating the stature. And I talk something about that. And you kind of measure the long bones, which the legs and the arms, particularly the humerus, the upper bone of the arm, and the femur, the upper bone in the leg. And there are formulas for this. There are formulas to determine if this is this long, then the individual was probably this tall. Again, rough estimates, but it can for sure tell the difference between someone who's 5'5 and someone who's 6'5. Okay, determining sex. This is difficult, and particularly in children, because children, until they reach puberty, they don't start developing many of the skeletal things that we see that we would call gender specific. So they just are children's bones. But if you have mature bones, if you have an adult, then certain things. One of the things they look at is the thickness of the bones in certain areas, like the orbital ridges. That's the part right above the eye sockets. The thickness of the humerus, the upper arm radius, the larger bone in the lower arm, and the femur tend to be a little thicker in males, but that's not always the case. And so you can't really say, okay, well, you know, this looks like a guy's bone, this looks like a girl's bone. You can't always tell that. But there are a couple of things. And the two most important bones in the body, or group of bones in the body, are the skull and the pelvis. In the pelvis, there's a thing called the sciatic notch, which is kind of a little notch out of the back of the pelvic wing. And there's pictures for this in both Forensics for Dummies and How Done It Forensics, and in some of the links I'll put in the show notes online. And you can see that the difference in the shape in this, in the women, it's more open, and in men it's more closed. Also, the flare of the wings of the pelvis are broader in women and more narrow in men, again in general. But this is usually pretty strong evidence as to whether you're dealing with a male or a female. The other thing is in the skull, and again, I talked about the supraorbital ridges being a little thicker in males for the most part, but the main thing is the mandible. The mandible is the jawbone. That's the part that's your lower jaw that moves up and down, and it's kind of L-shaped. And along the very back of it, called the ramus, we have big words for everything, the ramus of the mandible. In women, that tends to be a pretty much a straight line, and in men, it seems to be slightly curved in kind of a concave pattern. Again, there's pictures of this. So using the pelvis and the skull, you can determine the sex of the individual. Critically important in identifying the bones, because now at least you know which path to look down. There's been a lot of things about the shape of some of the bones, particularly the skull and whatnot, in racial characteristics, and these are real. They're not imagined. They are real, but they're not all that useful anymore, and particularly in the world of DNA. Also, there's been so much cross-culture, cross-racial breeding that all these rules get muddied and everything goes away, and so you can't really separate that much. Now, so let's say you've got an adult female, and you got their approximate age, their stature, maybe an estimate of their sex, I mean of their race. So now what? Good. What are you going to do next? What are you going to do next? So you got all these bones, and you got kind of a general description. Obviously, you're going to check missing persons and things like that, who it might be in the local area. But then the other thing you want to know is, how old are these bones? What's the difference between a bone that's 100 years old and a bone that's 20 years old? Well, there are differences, but they're not always just evident right at the time. If a 100-year-old bone is well preserved and a 20-year-old bone has been damaged by the environment, they may look the same. And that's very, very important in criminal investigations, because a 100-year-old bone, whoever did it is not around anymore, so it's a moot point. But a 20-year-old bone, there's no statute of limitations on murder. That makes a difference. And so you can see where this will immediately determine whether if this is a criminal case or not. So how old are these bones? Well, you can look at things at the burial site, like the clothing and jewelry and the casket materials and things. I also talked about this in the last discussion, but all of these things may give you a timeline. I mean, who knows? Maybe he has a folded newspaper in his pocket that has the date. But he could have a receipt that survived in some of the frayed clothing. He could have a driver's license that you know, expired X day. That these kinds of things could be found near the body and could have survived, you know, for the 5 or 6 years that the body laid there. It happens. You also do various chemical analyses. The various amino acids disappear from the bones at a variable rate, and so you can determine the amount of these various amino acids. Those are the building blocks of proteins that are in the bone, and they, like I said, they go away at a certain rate. So does nitrogen. Nitrogen is lost from the bones at a certain rate as they age. And these can give you estimates of the time since death. Well, this helps. Because if you're looking for someone who was a missing person from, 6 months ago versus someone who's a missing person from 6 years ago, you can see that your investigation will go down a different pathway. You can use ultraviolet light. If you cut across a bone and put it under UV light, it kind of glows through the full thickness of the bone in a fresh bone. But by the time it gets to be about 100 years old, this loses it. This loses its glowing ability, and it gradually happens toward a middle band from inside out and from outside in. And so if you do this, you can determine, well, these are fairly fresh bones, meaning a few years, versus anthropological bones from a century ago. And then you can use radioactive isotopes. This is interesting. You can use the amounts of carbon-14, strontium-90, cesium-137, and tritium, which is a radioisotope of hydrogen. Back in the 50s and 60s, there was an increase in the amounts of all of those because of nuclear testing. And all of us who were alive after that time period have incorporated these radioactive isotopes into our bodies because they're everywhere. They're all around the globe. They're everywhere. But if you died before these happened, then none of these are in your bones. So again, you can tell whether if a bone was left in the forest in 1940 versus one that was left in the forest in 1995. Okay. Then one of the most important and the things that is the cause and manner of death. Can bones help you determine the cause and manner of death? Now, most deaths, gunshot wounds and poisons and drugs and all, they're in the tissues. The tissues decay away. After time, 10 years later, all you got is bones. You're not going to be able to determine what the cause of death was. One of the things you see a lot about is whether it's strangulation or not, and this has been controversial. There is the little hyoid bone right there in the, it's a C-shaped bone. It's right in the throat near the Adam's apple, and it's very fragile, and in strangulations, and it can be fractured. Well, guess what? It can also be fractured by falling down or by getting hit in the throat, or as the body decays and it separates, it can break as it separates, because it's a free floating bone when the tissues thing, and it may not even be found at the scene because it is so tiny. But anyway, if you're looking for skeletal issues, obviously the skull is one of the places to look. If you see that the skull has been bashed in, then you can assume that that blunt force trauma had at least something to do with the death. Either it incapacitated the person severely, obviously if their skull's crushed, or it killed them. What if you find evidence on some of the bones of knife cuts or a bullet? Or what if you even find a little bit of a bullet fragment or the tip of a knife buried into a bone? Well, now you got something to work with, which not only will let you know that the homicide or at least some attack was involved in this, either with a gun or a knife or something like that, but also if you were to later identify a weapon, say a knife, and the tip was broken, and it matched the tip that was found buried in the femur or the spine or the skull of the dead guy that had been dead for 3 years. And then you can take those two pieces and, like a jigsaw puzzle, match them. That is hugely strong evidence that this is the knife that did the murder. And somebody, whoever has possession of that knife, has some explaining to do. So all of these things and the bony things that you look for are trauma to the bones. Now, here's one of the other problems. As I said, predators come along. Predators can come along and gnaw on bones and damage bones. And sometimes this is very difficult to determine. Now, the tooth marks and stuff that are found on the bones will often tell you what kind of predator it was, whether it was a pig or a wild dog or whatever it was, a bear. They often have different bite patterns and tooth patterns, and if they leave their marks in certain ways, sometimes you can tell at least the species that did it. Not that that's going to help identify the person that much, but it helps let you know what happened. Facial reconstruction has obviously huge now, and it's very important. You can take the skeleton, and they have formulas for determining what the likely thickness of the skin is over the various points. And a good reconstruction artist, forensic artist, can either make a drawing or a 3D model of the facial pattern of the individual based on the bones. So whether their eyes are wide set, whether their chin is long, whether their cheekbones are broad, all of these things will help determine what the person looks like, because the skin and muscles just kind of lay over the bones. The bones require determine the framework, just much like the framework of a house determines what that house is going to look like, even though cosmetically it may be different. You may have different materials and structures and colors and all that, but the basic structure is the same. Same way with the skull. So they can use, like I said, drawings and clay models or computer imaging now to help determine what this person likely looked like. Now, you've seen this on TV where they will show that, and then they will age progress it to what the person would look like now. This is a fascinating field, and it's something you can use in your stories. You can take old photographs of someone, and you can maybe a photograph from 20 years ago, and this person's been missing for 10 years. And now you find these things, and you take this old photograph from them from back in the day and compare it to the bones and say, yeah, okay, this sure looks like the person. At least the image fits the bone structure. Okay, so that helps. And in fact, in the famous case of the hunt for Josef Mengele, the famous angel of death, that did all the medical experiments at Auschwitz and places like that for the Third Reich. And you know, over 400,000 deaths, I think, were attributed directly to him. He was the one that would point right and left and right and left. He was basically choosing his subjects for his experimentation, and which ones he didn't care about. Yeah, really nice guy. Anyway, needless to say, Mossad and the Israelis, he was the crown jewel of all the post-war Nazi war criminals that they were hunting down. And they chased him all over South America, but he was very elusive. And in fact, there were very few, if any, truly verified sightings of this guy. There may have been one or two, if I remember correctly, one in Argentina, one in Paraguay, but I may be wrong on that. But they really wanted this guy. And they traced him and traced him and traced him and traced him. And finally, again, if memory serves, they found this couple, older couple, you know, peasants, nice people, have nothing to do with the Nazis. Said, yeah, he was here. He was hiding out over there. He was living in that place. And he drowned. He drowned out there in the lake, and we buried him. Really? Well, where did you bury him? Well, they went and dug the body up. Now, okay, so now they got the skeletal remains because he had died 20 years earlier. What are we going to do? So they took pictures of Mengele that were known to be him from back when he was a proud SS officer, and they laid them over the bones, and sure enough, they matched perfectly. So this was at least strong evidence based on the skeletal remains and on the photographic evidence, because everything matched up perfectly, that this was indeed Josef Mengele. But later, in the early 1990s, DNA samples were obtained from the bones, and they were compared to some of his relatives back in Germany, and an identification of the Angel of Death was done through the DNA. And DNA can be useful. In a skeleton, obviously you don't have the tissues and stuff to deal with, but what you have is the bones and the teeth. And the pulp of the teeth is a tissue that's where all the blood supply is. When you get a root canal, that's what they go in and mess with. When you get a toothache, that's the part that hurts. But that pulp, obviously contains blood and tissue, so it contains DNA. And the enamel of the teeth relatively protect it from decay and damage and all of that by time and the environment. So if you can't drill into the bones and find good DNA, you can often drill into the teeth and obtain good DNA. And so now you have a DNA profile. And I talked about this a little bit in the last lecture. If you have someone that you suspect this is the person and you have a sample of that person's DNA, maybe they're in the database from back in the day. Maybe they have an old toothbrush. Maybe they have envelopes that they had licked. Maybe they have something that they can obtain that person's DNA and then compare it to the skeletal remains and make an identification. Also, they can plug it into the system, like I said, and see if it's in the CODIS, the national database. And then they can use, and again, I talked about this in the last lecture, they can use familial DNA and sometimes the genealogical DNA, but familial DNA, let's say that they put this in the system and they find something that's similar. Well, now then they go, it's not the same person. Maybe this person's still alive. And so they go talk to this person and say, you know, we got this skeletal remains, we got this DNA. Well, yeah, my brother's been missing for 20 years, you know, ever since that bank robbery. He disappeared after the bank robbery. We don't know what happened to him. Well, now you have a place to look, and maybe this guy has something that would contain a DNA sample of his brother, and now they can go back to this. Bang. They can also use mitochondrial DNA to show that both of the skeletal remains and the supposed brother have the same mitochondrial DNA, which means they're related up the maternal line. They could have the same Y chromosomal DNA, which means they're related up the paternal line. So DNA can help, but you have to have something to compare it with. So you can see skeletal remains, which are very common in police work, and actually in a lot of thrillers and mystery novels too. They're complex, but they're very cool, and there's a lot of things that forensic anthropologist and the medical examiner can use. Now, as I said, there's a longer discussion with more detail on all of this in Forensics for Dummies and Howdunit Forensics. And I've also gathered together some websites that you can go to and read more about this, and they will all be on my blog and my website, so you can go there for further study. So until next time, this has been DP Lyle, and I look forward to seeing you down the road.